Prescott Presbyterian Church and Sovereign Grace Fellowship up in Williams. Welcome to another Sunday School or another family devotion, however you guys are using these resources. So you may notice right away I'm in a different venue. I'm here in my home office and in Ash Fork, actually, and that's part of the reason why I'm doing it here rather than church. This is moving week for the Claims, and so we are moving from our home in Chino Valley because our lease is almost up there, and we're really only guaranteed to be with you guys through the end of December. After December, who knows? So that's 6 months. It's not easy to find a 6-month lease. And so Jonathan and Suzanne Holmes offered their vacation home of sorts to us here in Ash Fork. And so we are moving here to Ash Fork for at least the next 6 months. And the Lord knows what's happening after that. But a little update on the Clings and what's going on in our lives, and you can be praying for us during the move. But then also, welcome to Sunday School, and welcome to my office. So today, we're going to continue our journey through Pilgrim's Progress. We're going to, once again, grab Christian's hand as he takes us from the City of Destruction to the Celestial City. If you remember from 2 weeks ago, we walked through the Valley of the Shadow of Death with Christian. And we talked a little bit about what the Bible, what kind of imagery the Bible is trying to convey to us when it talks about the shadow of death, and how Bunyan takes that imagery and brings it into this allegory in a way that hopefully was helpful or relates well to us. And so that was last week. This week we're going to skip two chapters. And the reason why we're skipping those two chapters is because they're just conversation. They don't really move the plot along. They're really good reads if you're just reading them by yourself, but maybe not in a kind of a community group Sunday school kind of a situation. So if you want to read those two chapters on your own, I encourage it. I'd be happy to email those chapters to you if you want a digital resource there. So today we're going to skip those two chapters. One of those chapters, Christian meets a man named Faithful. That's really all you need to know about those two chapters, because Christian and Faithful arrive on the scene right away in the chapter we're reading today. So that's where Faithful comes from, those two chapters. He's a faithful Christian, just like Christian from he's a faithful pilgrim, just like Christian from the City of Destruction. And so so he's a good companion, and you will see he really is the faithful Christian by the end of the chapter here today. So today we're going to read a chapter called Vanity Fair. That's what we're going to read today. And I'm not going to give you much intro there other than first, Christian and Faithful reunite with Evangelist. Evangelist gives them an exhortation, and then Christian and Faithful gets to the Vanity Fair. And you'll see what happens from there. I'm going to just kind of leave you at that because it is a longer reading, and I want to keep this introductory segment shorter here. So having said that, again, there's actually only two attachments today. I didn't give you a children's discussion guide for the little kids, simply because this chapter is a little bit longer and a little bit more advanced, and so I'm not sure if they're going to profit from it very much to begin with. And then secondly, I don't know how, if any of you have been using those and have really profited from them, I would love feedback so that I can know. Otherwise, I don't want to put them together every week when they're not being used. So. So having said that, the two attachments are the discussion guide and the actual chapter that I'm going to be reading from. So I'm going to give you a blank screen here. Maybe look through those questions just so you know what's coming. And if you want to follow along, grab your chapter that I emailed to you so you can follow along. And having said that, I'm going to give you the blank screen, and it will be story time. It's story time. So again, it's Vanity Fair this week, today, and you have this as an attachment in your email if you would like to follow along. So this week, Vanity Fair. I will start reading. So Christian and Faithful continued to talk about what they had seen on the way. And their conversation made the journey easier, which without a doubt would have been long and tiresome for them otherwise, because now they were going through a wilderness. Now when they were almost out of this wilderness, Faithful just happened to look back, and he saw someone he recognized coming behind them. "Oh," said Faithful to his brother, "who is that coming toward us?" Christian looked and said, It is my good friend Evangelist." "Yes, and my good friend too," said Evangelist, "for he was the man who showed me the way to the gate." Evangelist soon caught up with them and greeted them. "Peace be with you, dearly beloved, and peace be to those who help you." Christian responded, "Welcome, welcome, my good Evangelist. Just looking at you reminds me of the kindness you showed me a long time ago and of your untiring labors for my eternal good." "And 1,000 times welcome," said good Faithful. "How encouraging it is for us pilgrims to have your company, Evangelist." Evangelist responded, "How are things, my friends, since the last time we saw each other? What have you encountered and how have you conducted yourselves?" Then Christian Faithful told him about all the things that had happened to them on their journey and how, with great difficulty, they had arrived at the place where they now were. "I am so glad," said Evangelist, "not that you experienced the trials, but that you have been victorious. You have, even with many weaknesses, continued in the right way to this very day. I am glad of this for your sakes and for mine. I have sowed and you have reaped. The day is coming when both he who sows and those that reap will rejoice together. That is, if you continue in this way. For in due time you will reap if you do not lose heart. The crown is before you, and it is an incorruptible one. Run that you may obtain it. Some set out for this crown, and after they have gone a great distance to receive it, another comes along and takes it from them. Hang on, therefore, to what you have. Do not let anyone take your crown. You are not yet out of the range of the devil. You have not resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. Let the kingdom always be before you, and believe with all your heart in the things that are invisible. Let nothing that is on this side of the heavenly world get within you. And above all, guard your hearts and beware of the lusts that lie within, for they are deceitful above all things, and desperately wicked. Set your faces like a flint. You have all power in heaven and on earth on your side." Then Christian thanked him for this exhortation, and told him they would like for him to speak further to them so they could have this wisdom concerning the rest of their journey. They knew very well that he was a prophet and could tell them many things that might happen to them, and how they might resist and overcome them. Faithful agreed with Christian's request. So Evangelist began. "My sons, you have heard the words of the truth of the gospel, that you must through many afflictions and tribulations enter into the kingdom of heaven. In addition, you know that in every city chains and afflictions wait for you. Therefore, you cannot expect that you will go very far on your pilgrimage without them, in some form or another. You have already experienced the truth of these words, and more trials will immediately follow. As you can see, you are almost out of the wilderness. Before long, you will come to a town that you will be able to see. In that town, you will be faced with hardened enemies who will exert a lot of pressure on you and will ultimately kill you. You can be sure that the one or both of you will seal your testimony of Jesus Christ with your blood. But be faithful even unto death, and the king will give you a crown of life. He who dies there, although his death will be unnatural and his pain might be great, will have it better than the one who does not die. Not only will he arrive at the celestial city sooner, but he will also escape many hardships that the other will face during the rest of his journey. When you have come to the town and find everything happens as I have said, then remember me and conduct yourselves like men. Commit your souls to God, who is your faithful creator. Then I saw in my dream that when they had come out of the wilderness, they immediately saw a town in front of them. The name of the town is Vanity. The town has a fair called Vanity Fair, which is held all year long. It bears the name Vanity Fair because the town where it is held is less than vanity. Also, all that is sold there or brought into the town is vanity. There is a saying of the wise, "Everything is vanity," or everything is meaningless. Now, this fair is not a newly formed business. It has been around for a long, long time. I will show you how it got started. So almost 5,000 years ago, there were pilgrims walking to the celestial city, just as these two honest people are. Beelzebub, Apollyon, and Legion, with their companions, knew that the path the pilgrims took to the city went right through this town of vanity. So they decided to set up a fair where all sorts of vanity could be sold all year long. The fair offered all kinds of merchandise, including houses, lands, trades, places, honors, promotions, titles, countries, kingdoms, lusts, pleasures, and delights of all sorts, such as prostitutes, pimps, wives, husbands, children, masters, servants, lives, blood, bodies, souls, silver, gold, pearls, precious stones, and many other things. At any time, one may see jugglers, cheats, games, plays, fools, mimes, scoundrels, and beggars of every kind imaginable. And for no cost, anyone can see thefts, they can see murders, adulteries, and false witnesses. As in other fairs of less importance, there are many rows and streets with their appropriate names, where various wares are sold. So likewise here, you have places, rows, and streets where the merchandise is easily found. There is Britain Row, the French Row, Italian Row, the Spanish Row, the German Row, where several of vanities are sold. But as in other fairs, there is one main commodity that is marketed. Rome and all of her merchandise is greatly promoted at this fair. Only our English nation, with a few others, have objected to this. Of course, there's a reference to the Reformation there. Now, as I said, that the way to the celestial city lies right through this town where this lustful fair is held. The person who intends to go to the city and does not go through this town must actually go out of the world. The Prince of Princes himself, namely Jesus, when he was on earth, went through this town to his own country. And it was on a day when the fair was held. I think it was Beelzebub, the chief lord of the fair, who invited him to buy his vanities. He offered to make the lord of the fair. He offered to make him lord of the fair if he only would worship him as he went through the town. Because he was such a person of honor, Beelzebub took him from street to street and showed him all the kingdoms of this world in a very brief time. He attempted to allure the Blessed One to bid on and buy some of his vanities, but he had no desire for the merchandise, and he left the town without spending even a penny on these vanities. This fair, therefore, has been going on for a long time and is an extremely large fair. Now, these pilgrims, as I said, had gone through this fair, and so they did. However, as they entered into the fair, all the people there were stirred up. The whole town was in an uproar over them for several reasons. First, the pilgrims were dressed in clothes that were very different from the clothes that were sold at the fair. So the people at the fair stared at them. Some called them fools, some said they were troublemakers, others said they were foreigners. Secondly, the second reason why the town was in an uproar, they not only thought their clothes were strange, but also their speech. Very few people could understand what they said. They spoke the language of Canaan fluently, but those who managed the fair were men of this world. So from one end of the fair to the other, they viewed one another as foreigners. Thirdly, it greatly amused the merchandisers that these pilgrims passed by all their wares. They did not even care to look at them. If a vendor called out to them to buy something, they would put their fingers in their ears and cry out, "Do not look upon vanity." They would then look upwards, signifying that their trade and commerce was in heaven. Now one mockingly took a chance as he looked at the way the men carried themselves and said to them, "What will you buy?" But they looked at him solemnly and said, "We buy the truth." Because of those words, the people despised the men even more. Some mocked, some taunted, some shamed them, and some called upon others to strike them. Finally, pandemonium broke out in the fair. Everyone was stirred up to the point where Order was lost and everything was in confusion. Word was brought to the Great One of the Fair, who quickly came down and appointed some of his most trusted friends to examine these men, on account of whom the fair was almost destroyed. These examiners asked them where they were from and where they were going. They also asked why they were wearing such unusual clothes. The men told them that they were pilgrims and strangers in the world, and that they were going to their own country, which was the heavenly Jerusalem. They told them that they had not given any reason for the men of the town nor the merchandisers to mistreat them, and they asked him to let them go on their journey. They maintained that the only thing they had done was to state that they wanted to buy the truth when pressed to buy something. But the men appointed to examine the pilgrims did not believe them to be anything other than troublemakers who were mad, or else men who deliberately came to introduce confusion into the fair. Therefore, they took them and beat them and smeared them with dirt. They put them into a cage and that might make a spectacle of them for all the people of the fair to see. There they lay for some time and were made objects of anyone's sport or malice or revenge. The Great One of the fair was still laughing at all that had happened to them. But the men, being patient and not returning evil for evil, gave blessings instead and spoke good words for bad ones, and returned kindnesses for injuries that were done. Consequently, some men in the fair, who were more observant and less prejudiced than the rest, began to interfere and to blame the more corrupt men for their continual abuses against them. Responding with such anger, the ruthless men came at these men too, accusing them of being as bad as the men in the cage, and telling them that they had seemed like allies and should receive the same treatment. The others replied that, by the way they could see, the men were quite quiet and solemn and did not intend to harm anyone. They said there were many who traded in the fair who should have been put into the cage. Yes, and also the pillory. So that these men whom... Let me reread that sentence. They said that there were many who traded in the fair who should have been put into the cage and also the pillory, which was a device with holes for the heads and hands in which petty offenders were formerly locked and exposed to the public scorn. They should have been put into this pillory rather than the men whom they had mistreated. So after both sides exchanged words, the sympathizers and the aggressors, they began to fight and to injure one another. So then these two poor men were brought before the examiners again and were charged with the uproar that had taken place in the fair. So they severely beat them, put chains on them, and led them up and down the fair as an example to the others, and to strike fear in them lest any of them should speak up again on their behalf or join with them. But Christian and Faithful behaved with even greater wisdom. They received the disgrace and shame that was given to them with meekness and patience. As a result, several of the men in the fair were won to their side, even though it was a small number compared to the whole crowd. This puts the other party into a greater rage. So much so, in fact, that they decided the two men had to die. Therefore, they indicated that neither the cage nor chains would serve their purpose. The men needed to die for the abuses they had done and for causing injury to the men of the fair. See the blame shifting there? Then they were ordered back to the cage again until further action could be taken with them. So they put them in again and fastened their feet in the stocks. Here Christian and Faithful remembered what they had heard from their faithful friend, Evangelist. They knew these sufferings would happen because he had already told them. They also comforted each other, knowing that whoever would be called upon to suffer would be better off. So each man secretly wished that he might have the privilege. But committing themselves to the all-wise disposal of him who rules all things, they remained in their situation with contentment until their sentences were carried out. Then, having set a date and time, their accusers brought them forth to their trial in order to condemn them. They were brought before their enemies and arraigned. The judge's name was Lord Hategood. Their indictment was one and the same in substance, although it varied in form. The charges were as follows. So this is kind of a summary of the charges here. That they were enemies to and disturbers of their trade. That they had made commotions and divisions in the town and had won other people over to their own dangerous opinions in contempt of the law of their prince. So then Faithful answered that he had only resisted those who were against him who is of higher than the highest. And, he said, as for the disturbances, I did not make any. Being a man of peace, the people who were one to us were won by seeing our truth and innocence, and they have only turned from that which is worse to that which is better. And as to the king you talk about, Beelzebub, the enemy of our Lord, I defy him and all his angels. Then a proclamation was made that those who had anything to say for their Lord against the prisoners would immediately appear to give their evidences. Three witnesses came forward: envy, superstition, and pickthank. Pickthank is another word for a flatterer. And you probably see some flattery in pickthank's proclamation here. So these men were asked if they knew the prisoner at the bar and what they had to say for their Lord against the king against them. So envy stood up and said, "My Lord, I have known this man a long time, and I will attest upon my oath before this honorable bench that he is..." Oops, stop! Lord Hategood, the judge said, "Give him his oath." So they swore him in. Then Envy said and continued, "My Lord, this man, irrespective of his name, is one of the vilest men in our country. He does not regard the prince nor the people, the law or custom. He does all he can to control all men with certain of his disloyal notions, which he calls the principles of faith and holiness. In particular, I myself heard him once affirm that Christianity and the customs of our town of Vanity were diametrically opposed to one another and could not be reconciled. By saying this, my Lord, he immediately condemns not only all of our praiseworthy actions, but also us when we do them." "Do you have more to say?" the judge said. Envy responded, "My Lord, I could say much more. I just do not want to consume the court's time. After the other gentlemen have given their evidence, if there is anything lacking that would ensure the death penalty, I will enlarge my testimony against them." So he was told to stand by. Then they called Superstition and asked him to look at the prisoner. They also asked what he could say for the Lord, for their Lord the King against him. Then they swore him in, and he began, "My Lord, I am not very well acquainted with this man, neither do I desire to know him any better. However, this I know, that he is a troublesome person. I talked with him the other day in this town, and I heard him say that our religion was nothing, and that by our religion there was no way to please God. You know, my Lord, what must necessarily follow from this sayings, that we worship in vain, we are still in our sins, and are finally condemned. This is what I have to say." Then Pickthank, the flatterer, was sworn in and encouraged to say what he knew on behalf of their Lord, the King, against the prisoner at the bar. And so Pickthank said, "My Lord, and all of you gentlemen, I have known this fellow for a long time. I have heard him speak things that ought not to be spoken. He has violently complained against our noble Prince Beelzebub, and has spoken with contempt about his honorable friends, whose names are the Lord Old Man, the Lord Carnal Delight, the Lord Luxurious, the Lord Desire of Vainglory, my old Lord Leckery, Sir Having Greedy, and all the remaining nobility. He has said that if all men like him, none of these men, he said that if all men thought like him, none of these men would have a presence in this town. Besides, he has not been afraid to speak against you, my Lord, who has now been appointed to be his judge, with many other vilifying terms which he has stained most of the noble people of our town." When Pickthank had told his tale, the judge directed the speech to the prisoner at bar, saying, "You drifter, heretic, and traitor, have you heard what these honest gentlemen have witnessed against you?" Faithful responded, "May I speak a few words in my own defense?" The judge said, "You fool, fool! You do not deserve to live any longer. You deserve to be slain immediately, right here. Yet, so that all people can see our gentleness toward you, let us hear what you have to say." Faithful responded, In my response to what Mr. Envy has said, I never said anything but this, that the rules, laws, customs, or people that are specifically against the word of God are diametrically opposed to Christianity. If I have said something wrong in this, convince me of my error. I am ready to make my retraction right here before you. And as to the second person who spoke, namely Mr. Superstition, and his charge against me, I have said this, that in the worship of God there is required a divine faith. But there can be no divine faith without a divine revelation from the will of God. Of course, whatever is done in the name of God that is not in agreement with divine revelation is only done by human faith. That faith will not give anyone eternal life. And as to what Mr. Pickthank said, I say, avoiding terms that I supposedly said like I violently complained, and words like these, I say that the prince of this town, with all his riffraff, his attendants who are named by him, are more fit for hell than for being in this town and country. And so the Lord have mercy on me. Then the judge spoke to the jury, who all this while stood by to hear and to observe. The judge spoke to the jury. He said, "Gentlemen of the jury, you see this man about whom such a great uproar has been made in this town. You have also heard what these worthy gentlemen have witnessed against him. Also, you have heard his replying confession. It now lies in your power to hang him or save his life. Yet I think it necessary to instruct you as to our law." And so the judge continues to talk about their law so the jury can make their correct decision. He says, "Legislation was enacted in the days of Pharaoh the Great, servant of our prince, that the males of a different religion should be thrown into the river to prevent these people from multiplying and growing too strong for him. There was also a law passed in the day of Nebuchadnezzar the Great, another of his servants, that whoever would not fall down and worship his golden image should be thrown into a fiery furnace. In the days of Darius, a law was enforced that whoever for a period of time called upon any god but his would be thrown into the lion's den. Now this rebel has broken the substance of these laws, not only in thought, which cannot be known, but also in word and deed. This is intolerable." Pharaoh's law was made from a supposition in order to prevent problems in the future. No crime had yet been committed, but here a crime apparent. In his second and third arguments, he disagrees with our religion. Because he has confessed his treason, he deserves to die. So the jury went out, and Bunyan explains the names of the juries, and essentially each person, each person says he's guilty. "So they, therefore, brought him out to do with him according to their law. First they scourged him, then they beat him and lanced his flesh with knives. After that they stoned him with stones and pricked him with their swords. Last of all, they burned him to the ashes at the stake. This is the way Faithful came to his end." Now I say that there stood behind the crowd a chariot and a couple of horses waiting for Faithful, who, as soon as his enemies had killed him, was taken up into it and immediately carried up through the clouds with the cloud of a trumpet, the fastest way to the celestial city. As for Christian, he had some rest and was sent back to prison. He remained there for some time. But he who overrules all things, having the power of their rage in his own hand, he made a way for Christian to escape, and he went on his way. And as he went singing this song. "Well, Faithful, thou hast faithfully professed unto thy Lord, with him thou shalt be blessed. When faithless ones, with all their vain delights, are crying out under their hellish plights, Sing, faithful, sing, and let thy name survive. For thou they killed thee, thou art yet alive. And that is the end of this chapter about Vanity Fair and the persecution that happens when the passions of the flesh are given full reign and sovereignty in a person's heart. So take a moment, discuss the questions, and I will answer some of the questions myself. Well, you've heard the story now, and maybe you've had some discussions, maybe not, but I'm going to go ahead and use this discussion guide as I have in the previous weeks as just kind of a way to provide some insights into the story here. So the first question there, it says that the evangelist alluded to two different kinds of temptations or trials which a Christian may face. And an allusion may be a little bit too strong of a word here. This is just something I saw that I think Bunyan was doing in the story, just following biblical patterns, as Bunyan does. And so this is what Evangelist said to Christian faithful. Evangelist said, "You are almost out of this wilderness." So Christian and faithful are in a wilderness. In fact, the first two paragraphs of this chapter, that point is reiterated several times, that Christian and faithful are walking through the wilderness, and they're walking out, and then they see Evangelist. And here Evangelist says, "You're almost out of the wilderness, and before long you will come to a town that you will not, you will come to a town that you will be able to see." So Christian and faithful are going, they're in the wilderness, and now they're coming to a town. And Christian, or Evangelist is warning Christian and faithful of the kinds of temptations and trials that they're going to experience in the town, supposing possibly that these are different temptations and trials that they might have experienced in the wilderness, right? And that is true. That's true of the biblical pattern. So the temptations and the trials that we experience in the wilderness are more internal. They're the desires of the flesh which wage war against your soul, as 1 Peter talks about. They're internal, and that's what Israel experienced, right? Israel was in the wilderness, and they didn't have enemies surrounding them and giving them that trial. the temptations and the problems, the trials were not coming from outside. When you're in the wilderness, you quickly realize that your real problem is yourself and your sin, the desires of the flesh that are indwelling within you, that are remaining within you. And you also, I mean, of course, you also have the devil at work. So when Jesus was in the wilderness, he experienced the internal temptations, I'm sure, but some of those temptations were being brought to him from the devil. And we do experience that ourselves as well. But I mean, so there's the wilderness temptations, but then when you get out of the wilderness and you come and you're faced with the world, those are different kinds of temptations. The temptations of the world, either your flesh is going to cry out for the world in a faithless cry saying, "I want to be satisfied with the world, but I can't have the world." You see the same root problem here. You're not ultimately being satisfied by God. You're either crying out for the world, the desires of the flesh are, or they're clinging on to the world and not to God. You're either crying out to the world, not to God, or you're clinging to the world and not to God. When you're in the city, you're clinging to the world, not to God, and you are forgetting God. And so you could remember Deuteronomy chapter 6. This has always been a passage I've kept in my mind, and it's readily applicable to us Christians today. So Moses speaks before Israel, and he says this to Israel as Israel is about to cross the Jordan into the promised land. And he says, "When the Lord brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give to you," and he describes this land. This is a land with great and good cities that you did not build. These are houses that you did not fill with good things that you did not fill, cisterns you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees you did not plant. "And when you eat and when you are full and happy and satisfied with the things of this world, take care lest you forget the Lord." Take care lest you forget the world. When you get the opportunity to cling on to the worldly goods that God has given, it's very easy for your flesh to take over and not to receive the world by faith as a gift from God, to receive it with a faithful gratitude to God. It's very easy to receive it with the flesh. And when you do that, you forget the Lord. And so that's the temptation that you experience as you go into this, the Vanity Fair, when you go into the city that you can see and taste and touch and smell. So those are the two temptations. Now let's go into a little bit more discussion about the nature of these temptations in the city, the nature of the temptations in Vanity Fair. Question two here. Bunyan adopts the name Vanity Fair from the concept in Ecclesiastes that everything is vanity. Okay, so that's Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 2. Bunyan quoted that verse, and everything is vanity. Let's just take a moment and just think. What does Ecclesiastes mean by this, that everything is vanity? The scholars have debated a long time and a lot about the meaning of this word vanity. The word is hevel in Hebrew, and that word can be translated a couple different ways, and a lot of people think it just means meaningless or just pointless. Is that what Ecclesiastes is getting at? This is just all meaningless. When you read Ecclesiastes, you see the preacher, the person writing Ecclesiastes, the narrator, he's looking at the world and he's seeing all these contrasts, and they're not just contrasts, like they're paradoxes, and they're painful paradoxes. They produce pain. They're marked by curse and death. And it's those sorts of the wicked prosper. That's kind of, that in God's paradigm, in God's kingdom, that would be a paradox, right? That the wicked prosper, and all people die. I mean, it's a very grim book as we oftentimes read it. And therefore we oftentimes think everything's meaningless. Everything's pointless. Why live this life? I don't think that's what the Ecclesiastes is getting at. What Ecclesiastes is getting at, I'll turn to the last chapter of Ecclesiastes. What Ecclesiastes is getting at is that everything is mysterious. And that's another way to translate the word hevel, another way to translate the word vanity, what the word that is often translated as vanity. That you could say hevel means enigmatic, enigma, mysterious, unexplainable. And I think that's more in line with what Ecclesiastes get to. I'm talking and trying to turn to Ecclesiastes, and it's not working very well here. One second. There we go. So in the last chapter of Ecclesiastes, we get the conclusion of Ecclesiastes. And this is what we read in verse 13. It says that this is the end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Why? Because God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. So God's going to bring everything into judgment. Okay, so that doesn't sound like everything's meaningless. That means that to me sounds like everything is going to its appointed end and to its appointed purpose in God, who will judge everything according to his righteousness and thereby glorify himself. The point of the matter here is that everything's mysterious. So that's when we think of everything's vanity, we often go to Ecclesiastes. Everything's meaningless. I don't think that's what we're supposed to read in Ecclesiastes, that everything's meaningless. Everything's mysterious. Yes, everything's going to be, we just don't know how everything's going to glorify God. So that's one just clarifier of what we might often think of everything as vanity. Clarifying the book of Ecclesiastes there on that point. Now, Bunyan takes this Vanity Fair, and he's using the word vanity, I think, in a way that it's supposed to be used. When we take the things of this world and let our flesh cling on to the good things of this world that God has made as good for our use and for our enjoyment and our pleasure in him, as we receive the things of this world by faith with faithful, thankful gratitude. So that's one way to receive those things by faith in gratitude to God. That was the point of God giving Israel this promised land to prosper under God's kingdom, with thankful gratitude in faith in God. But Israel didn't do that. Israel clung to these things in the flesh and desired the things as ends in of themselves. And that is vanity. That's the vanity. The desires of the flesh make the good things of this world. They don't make them vanity. They use the good things of this world and distort them and twist them in a way that that is vain. Okay? So God did not make everything meaningless, and everything is going to be directed towards God's judgments in the end. But we do, in our sinful flesh, grab hold of the good things of this world, and we use them in ways that are vain, empty, meaningless. There's no promises in this world when you go to this world in a way that God did not desire us to use the world. So, I mean, that kind of, so the next question there, question three, Bunyan includes wives and husbands in a list of vanities which describe the town of vanity. And he says, in this town of vanity, the vain things are, he includes wives and husbands right alongside pimps and prostitutes. Okay, so God made marriage. Isn't marriage good? Yes, but it becomes a vain thing when the flesh grabs hold of it and uses it in a way that God did not design it to be used. And so just that's how I understand vanity, and that's what was happening at Vanity Fair. This world is not evil. This world is not meaningless. Sin, the sin in your heart, and the sinful desires of your flesh go to this world in vain ways, and that's the vanity. Okay, so having said that, go enjoy the world with faith and thankful gratitude to God, your maker, and there you will glorify God. If you go to this world without faith in God and gratitude, you're going to find your, it's just vanity, okay? Now, the next question, I'm just going to answer this last question, and I'll be done. Because question number five there, and I think this is one of the biggest insights that I received out of this chapter. Question five, why might you suppose Bunyan chose to insert a martyrdom in a town called Vanity? Or why would he include a martyrdom in a chapter about Vanity Fair? How does Vanity Fair and a world full of vanity, how does that, why would Bunyan say, I want to put a martyrdom in that chapter? To answer that question, my mind goes to Galatians. And so you can go to Galatians chapter 6. Let me see here. Let me check. Galatians. I had it written down, but let's see here. Yep, there it is. Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5, verse 16. And this is what Paul says in Galatians 5, 16. He says, I say, walk by the Spirit. So walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. So those desires of the flesh that grab hold of the world in vain ways, if you're walking by the Spirit, grabbing hold of the world with thankfulness to God and faith, walking by the Spirit in true righteousness and holiness and truth. Therefore, if you're doing that, you cannot gratify the desires of the flesh. It doesn't happen. There's no intermingling between walking in the flesh and walking by the Spirit. There's no intermingling there. Okay? In fact, Paul goes on to say the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. So what happens when the desires of the Spirit, when a man walking by the Spirit encounters a man who's walking by the flesh? What happens is that they come against each other. And the man who's walking by the Spirit is walking in good conscience with faithful gratitude to his Maker, in righteousness, in truth. And when he does that, the man walking by the flesh is condemned. Because the man walking by the Spirit looks at the fleshly man and says, you are not giving glory, or you are not giving thankfulness and walking by faith before your Creator, and therefore you stand condemned. And a lot of times, the person walking in the flesh just knows this. They look at the Christian, and they might say, oh, that person's just religious, and he feels all pomp and arrogance and prideful. Well, no, I'm walking in gratitude to my Maker. I'm walking in faithfulness to according to true righteousness, holiness, and peace. You are not. And the man walking in the flesh can perceive that. And what happens then is that He feels condemned. He is condemned. And he's going to oppose the Spirit. He's going to persecute the Spirit, the man walking by the Spirit. And that, I mean, if you were to boil down, what is the root cause of persecution and martyrdoms in this world? The root cause is that men, by nature, suppress the truth that they are created in the image of God. They suppress the truth that they're judged, that they need God's grace, and they continue to walk in the flesh, in the desires of the flesh. And when a Christian comes alongside them and confronts them, even just by being around them, dressing the way that they dress, talking the way that they talk, they stand condemned, and they're going to lash out and try to defend themselves. And that, I mean, that's the boilerplate, bottom line, where martyrdoms come from. So, and I think that Bunyan was trying to get at that point, that the walking by the Spirit, walking by the flesh, not just indifferent to one another, they're opposed to one another. And so do not be a conflicted Christian. It's going to cause problems if you try to do both. They're opposed to one another. And then also recognize that when you walk according to the Spirit, those who walk according to the flesh are going to hate you. They're going to put up their defenses against you and try to shame you and persecute you. So expect it and trust in the Lord, and recognize that you have a heavenly inheritance awaiting for you, just as faithful did. Faithful knew that it was better to go be with the Lord than to continue and remain here. So trust the Lord. Having said that, I think we're good. We'll call that a wrap. So if you have any more questions about the questions that I didn't touch on, you're more than welcome to email me or call me. I'd love to talk about the rest of these questions with you if you want. God bless.